Welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. Check out our website at www.thewildernessmedic.com.
Expedition resources, wilderness medicine blog, and much more.
Hi, welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. My name's Daniel, and today I'm really excited to be joined by Donna Finnis. So Donna is a paramedic and based in the southeast of the UK. She's also an expedition medic who's worked on expeditions up Kili, been in the frozen northwest of Mongolia, which is what we're going to talk a bit about today. And when she's not out on expedition, she works frontline as a paramedic, has lots of experience on sporting events, teaching wilderness medicine, which is how we first met. And she also, in case that's not enough, she also sort of worked with Lowland Search and Rescue and is also a Coast Guard. So welcome to the podcast, Donna.
Hello.
Great to have you. So, yeah, we're going to have a bit of a chat about Mongolia, which having, yeah, you know, just before we press record, we were talking about some of the photos on it. It looks amazing. Definitely a bucket list place, but probably one that maybe few people have gone to. But just before we sort of delve into that, just tell us a bit about your journey, I guess, and how you got into expedition medicine.
Yes, so I guess it all started 20-plus years ago when I started working as a ski instructor and loved working in the outdoors, worked at an education centre in Kent, went to live in France, worked in Austria. When I came back from France to live in Brighton, I missed a lot of my outdoor world and joined Lowland Search and Rescue to have a little bit more exposure into the community here and the outdoors. And that sort of sparked a bit of an interest in providing care for people in more interesting different environments. And that led...
Okay. And were you a paramedic at this point, or was that the, sort of the first step in your journey from sort of ski-based stuff to search and rescue?
Yeah, so that was my first step towards it. There were a number of people in our team who were already working for the ambulance service who inspired me to then move in that direction.
Excellent. And you said that journey obviously started a bit of time ago, and then you became a paramedic and started out, I suppose, as lots of newly qualified paramedics do, sort of in the front line and building up your clinical skills and experience and things. And then how did that transition, I suppose, to, you know, working in Mongolia or up Kili? It's a bit different from the streets of Brighton, I guess.
It certainly is. I think the fact that I had this I enjoyed working in different environments led me to follow work in events. So initially it was working at Lewis Bonfire, which is probably the biggest bonfire society in the UK. It has about 5,000 participants, 80,000 spectators. You get some quite unique injuries there. And I worked with Brighton & Hove Albion and the football club, and for Brighton Marathon as well. That led to looking for a bit work further afield within the UK, and I started working on ultra marathons all over the UK, really.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a similar path. A lot of people, you know, particularly starting off getting a bit of pre-hospital experience, and then gradually expanding that within the UK and sort of ultramarathons. Yeah, interesting you mentioned the Lewis Bonfire. That always seems to make headlines. Usually, not necessarily the injuries. I think it's normally the weird and wacky kind of figures and guys that they make. I never made it down there, even though I lived relatively near, but maybe one day. And
it's quite effective.
Yeah, let's have a bit of a chat about the Brighton Marathon, because I know you're still involved with working on that, aren't you? You've been doing that for a little bit, and there's obviously lots of different things that can happen on there. What are the main challenges you faced working on sort of sporting events like that?
Yeah, so the Brighton Marathon is very different to working on the ultras. I started working on the Brighton Marathon first. I've been working in the Finnish tent for a number of years. We've been very, very lucky, as there's a huge research team that works down there. And we've had training in the past with pre-hospital ECMO, who have always been on site for the marathon. And then the more recently, we've had a focus on managing exertional heat illness. There's the founder, Dr. Ross Hemingway, has been there with his team with an ice cold water immersion kit for use with runners who suffer with heat stroke, which we found has happened on a number of occasions, even in the cooler British temperatures on the south coast. This year I think it was about 12 degrees and we had 3 patients that we used the kit for.
That's really interesting, isn't it? And I know obviously we're going to focus a bit more on cold a bit later, but yeah, you don't think heat stroke would necessarily occur in that kind of temperature, do you? So that's really interesting. And I guess having that research, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of cutting edge stuff if you've got sort of pre-hospital ECMO set up and things. That must be really interesting to work with.
Yeah, it's a really fabulous event to work on, actually. There's a lot that goes on.
Yeah, and I guess, yeah, we're speaking of sort of, you know, very high-end, having, you know, what sounds like fully functioning resus capabilities. And then I suppose we contrast that with, even within the UK, you know, some ultramarathons and events and things can still be pretty remote, can't they? And I suppose, how does that compare?
I think having the experience of the events where there's a lot of resources available, you learn how to manage patients, and then when you move into areas where there are less facilities and you're in a more remote environment, you've built up that experience of what you need to do, and you look at the position that you're in and work out how you can do your best to facilitate that same kind of treatment.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And that experience, I suppose, as well, of sort of seeing those common presentations, working out what fits, but also maybe being more comfortable in dealing with uncertainty, maybe, as you know, as you do gain that experience.
Exactly.
And things.
Absolutely. Yes.
And then, so how did you progress to ending up in Mongolia? Let's chat a bit about that.
And so as I was looking for more work further afield within the UK, I started working for a company based in Leicester, and they have a whole host of work within the UK, and they also have clients who seek medics for international work. They have a matrix, so you have to fulfill some of the matrix
sort of grid, like sort of an experience risk assessment type thing, is it?
Exactly. Looking that, yes. Yes. It's a little bit like a point system in that respect. And when you have fulfilled a certain number of the categories on the matrix, you then are available for international work.
Okay. A bit similar to the Faculty of Pre-Hospital Care had a similar document. It's not exactly points-based, but it's looking at your clinical skills and maybe where you're going, the distance to definitive care and things like that, and then combining it all to sort of see how you can safely go on it. So I imagine they probably based it on something similar. And then, so what exactly was the event? It was another sort of ultramarathon of sorts, but just in an extreme environment, I guess, was it?
Yeah, it was considered an adventure race, possibly one of the hardest in given the environment. It's a traverse north to south. It's 100 miles across a frozen lake in the depths of Outer Mongolia.
What could possibly go wrong?
Indeed. It is not all walking, running, so they have the option to skate, ski, or fat bike across the lake as well.
Okay, yeah.
So it's a race where it's about completion and enjoyment and fulfilment of the event rather than who comes first place.
Yeah, of course. It's just the challenge and the accomplishment of doing that sort of thing is winning in itself, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, exactly.
And how many people were doing this challenge then?
We had 44 participants, all over the world. I think we had a large proportion from Australia. We had some from Austria. We had some from America. And a number from the UK as well.
Yeah. That's interesting about the Australians, isn't it? Maybe because it's nice and hot there, they did a bit of a change. Interesting. And were most people, because you mentioned obviously there's a few different ways that they could complete this, I assume they had to stick with whatever mode of transport they started, or could they chop and change as they went along?
No, they could actually chop and change. So sometimes the conditions weren't suitable for skating or skiing. The terrain just changed. And this year, in fact, there was more snow on the lake than they've experienced in the past. So it made it a little less skateable. And the terrain, come across the middle of the lake, it becomes almost like, I likened it to being on the moon, the ice formed. And it was very, very sort of challenging terrain for them. They couldn't have skated across there.
Okay, so they may have sort of started off skates and then transitioned to walking or kind of cross-country skiing or...
Anything. It's very flexible, so they can do anything.
Yeah, interesting. And were they self-sufficient in that they had to pull all their shelters and things like that with them as well?
How
did that side of things work?
It's a very supported event. Uh-huh. And there's a whole team of individuals who will put up camp, and then they will break down the camp in the morning and travel, and they will bring all of the bags and equipment with them. So they'll leave at about 8 o'clock in the morning and arrive at the next camp before us.
I see. That's quite a nice way of doing it, I think. Certainly some of these challenges, I mean, the doing it in itself sounds difficult enough to me, let alone having to sort of manage your own stuff.
Indeed, yes.
And carry all that as well. So what was your main role there was it yourself and another clinician, was it?
That's correct, yeah. There were two of us on this event due to the number of people and participants out there and the supporting team as well. So there were two of us, and we spoke before we arrived, but we hadn't met before. We first met in Mongolia at the airport and travelled around 14 hours from the main airport in Ulaanbaatar, to our first stop, and provide medical assistance to the participants, the team, and in fact, individuals that we came across throughout the event. There was one instance where my colleague was approached by another expedition team, and he had to go off and assist them because they had a participant who had an undisclosed medical condition, and they had reportedly had a seizure, epileptic. So everyone that really
just shows you what can happen, doesn't it? I guess non-disclosure obviously is a risk, and I take it that trip didn't have a medic with them then.
They did not, no.
No, interesting. Okay. And as the race progressed, did you sort of follow the race along with those support teams and things? Was that how it worked?
We did. We split into two teams throughout the day, and each day we would change roles. So we would start our morning with a clinic, and there was a lot of foot care, MSK, that we managed in the mornings. And then we would set off at around 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. One of us would be mobile on course all day in a vehicle, and the other would sit about halfway midpoint through the race. Although whilst that was the plan, sometimes the weather then meant that we didn't quite get to our stations because it was too cold and participants were struggling. So that was very flexible.
Okay, and was it flexible in terms of where the finish for each day was, given possible weather conditions and things like that? Because I guess it's always a challenge, isn't it, getting that balance of completing an event versus completing it safely?
So the finish each day was a set point because it had to be on a safe campsite. We had that. It was a very supported race, so if individuals were suffering from the cold, they could come into one of the support vehicles. We also had two ponies and carts so that the individuals could be picked up on course and boosted along to one of the safe points for shelter. So they were very safe throughout the entire course. And our roaming medic, whether it was myself or my colleague for the day, would be moving throughout the course, and individuals would give us a thumbs down if they needed a little bit of assistance or respite.
Yeah.
Or they would wave at us in joy as we passed them.
Excellent. And I have to ask, I assume you weren't passing them in with the pony and the cart?
No, I didn't get the opportunity. It's a very, very cold journey. Pony and trap.
Well, it's a nice green, sustainable solution, I guess, rather than having a snowmobile or something like that. But that's really interesting. And I suppose you mentioned foot care, obviously, at the start of the day, often being a challenge, and you're definitely going to be aching, regardless of which transport modality. So I suppose aches and pains are going to be common. What other challenges or medical issues? I mean, we'd have to get into specific cases and things, but were there any other kind of common things that you came across?
So naturally, in that kind of environment, there were some very, very cold digits, which we managed with water baths. We had access to warm up water. We could access water from the lake by drilling holes, or we could heat that water up to create water baths on course. We had, for obviously, there's fire is a risk. We've got big campfires and small fires inside the GERS that were at the campsites. And we had a palm hand burn to deal with. Other than that, it was very much managing the cold and dehydration.
Yeah.
Things like that. People they didn't really necessarily always account for how dehydrated they might get even in that cold environment.
That's really interesting, I think, because often you'd think, in a desert, I'm going to become dehydrated because it's really hot. But I suppose cold environments equally, and if you're exerting yourself, there's going to be that risk, isn't there? I suppose a lot of this comes into sort of pre-trip briefings and things like that, which I guess as a medical team, something you were sort of involved in as well.
Yeah, we ran two. On the first day when we were on the south of the lake, we had one day after our 14-hour journey across country to get there. We had a day, I would like to say, of rest, where we held a registration and medical briefing in the morning, and we covered some of the hot topics that they need to be careful of.
Very appropriately named.
Sort of tried to balance being honest and open about the risks and seeking assistance from us if they were concerned, but also looking after themselves, because it's really important that individuals are able to do that when they're in those environments as well, and know when it's right and appropriate to come and seek help from us.
I think that's always the challenge, isn't it? Kind of getting the correct balance between sort of, getting people to do some self-care, but you don't want them to self-care until they sort of collapse and then think, oh, why didn't you tell me about that?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's always a challenge. And did people have to do any qualifying either cold-based activities or longer distance things beforehand? Or is it a case that they can just sort of be like, I quite fancy that, have a go and then sort of see what happens?
No, they don't have to do anything. Because it's so supported and so inclusive, they don't have to have done any particular preparation for it.
Okay. That's obviously why it is more sort of supported and things like that, isn't it? So that makes sense. Interesting. Can you see yourself doing it as a participant? Or do you think staying aside of the medical team is more where we're at?
I would absolutely love to do that as a participant. It's such a phenomenal environment. It would just be beautiful to be out there.
Yeah, and obviously it's really hard to convey how it was just using audio. But tell us a bit about how beautiful it was and the sort of landscapes you were traveling through, because I've seen some pictures and it just looks amazing.
Yes, I think I'd done my research beforehand, and when I came into land, we'd flown overnight and sun was just rising when we came into land in Ulaanbaatar, and I'd taken a seat by the window, and the view from the window just gave the real gravitas of where we were going. As this is vast, pristine, snow-covered steppe, there's nothing. It's completely devoid of any life. There's no roads, no villages, no anything, because you're coming into land. And that became secondly evident when we then travelled the 14 hours across land, passing through very, very few towns or villages or settlements en route. And it's beautiful. It's just beautiful. The mountains, the snow. There's some areas with trees, but not so many. Around the lake, we did have a forest, so that was very beautiful. And the sunrises and sunsets, the pinks, the blues in the sky, just absolutely stunning.
I know, it sounds great. And you said, obviously, in terms of population, relatively sparse and things. I guess in terms of, you know, if something would go wrong and things like that, you're always worried only about getting back, particularly if it's a 14-hour journey to get to places. I mean, what sort of medical backup did you have? I know that's always a concern when you're sort of weighing up whether to go and work on some of these sorts of events or expeditions.
Yes, we had a lot of pre-planned paperwork for this event. We knew that our extrication was going to be extremely long should we need it. The nearest main hospital is in Ulaanbaatar, that 14-hour drive away.
Yeah.
There is very, very little chance of getting a helicopter evacuation. It's all run by Mountain Rescue. They don't really use it.
Okay.
There was a very local hospital, but it's very unlikely we'd have used it. We'd have been looking really to get people back to Ulaanbaatar if we needed assistance.
Mm. Interesting, yeah. And I think that highlights like one of those issues, isn't it? I think whenever we sort of, potentially when we discuss on courses or other things, we're like, oh no, it'll be fine, we'll just get a helicopter to come. And it's... Yeah, not often. It's not the reality, is it? So I think that's that's interesting. And having, I mean, that's quite a prolonged extraction, isn't it? 14 hours, by presumably quite difficult roads as well, if it's all covered in snow and things.
The road was clear. It's the only one road. It was clear, and it is thankfully now tarmacked. I don't know how long it's been tarmacked, but it's not very long. Yeah. I think less than a decade. Mm. Prior to that, it was a dirt track.
Yeah, okay, there you go. Mm. And I suppose, we've touched on it a little bit, but I guess what were the best bits of that experience, kind of heading out to Mongolia?
I think the beauty of the landscape really, really astounded me. Every day I tried to spend time just to take it in, because it's a very busy event. These days are very long, they're very busy. It's easy to forget where you are sometimes. So I made a point of stopping and taking it in every single day. And one of my best bits, bizarrely, was being actually unable to sleep one night. The area I'd been given to sleep in was on a slope, and everything just continually sliding down the whole night, no sleep. So I got up at about 4 a.m. and went out for a walk, and the main campfire was still being stoked, but otherwise there was nobody else around. It was absolutely beautiful. I've got the most magical photos that I took of the teepees under the moonlight with this fire in the background. It's like, looks like something from Harry Potter, and it was a really magical moment of just being there all on my own.
Yeah, and that's the reason why we do a lot of these things, isn't it, I guess? And you mentioned, I think that's really important as well, that it can be quite hectic working on all of these different kinds of expeditions. And sometimes it's really hard to find that time for ourselves just to kind of relax or have some mindfulness or something like that. So that's really important. And I guess that's one of the potential challenges that we get as well, isn't it, on these sorts of things. Were there any other challenges that you found, obviously doing, I mean, the temperature obviously can be a challenge, can't it? But so is there any other things that were maybe different from what you'd expected at all?
I think the day that I lost my colleague all of a sudden to another group was unexpected. Yes. You're in an environment so far away from anyone. I didn't think that I'd lose him to another group. Maybe if we've had to have taken somebody off the event, I might.
Mm.
So I've sort of had that in my mind. But being responsible for the entire event for that period of time, and not knowing when he was going to come back, I think, was just something that I had as a small challenge to myself. And comms were down that morning. So comms, we get very used to radio working, that there were some barriers. Sometimes all comms would go. Sometimes we, in areas where we would expect to have comms, we didn't have them.
Yeah.
It was very unpredictable.
Okay. What were you using of interest?
So we had Sapphone out there, but we didn't really use it much. The event went very smoothly. So when comms were down, we just had our plan A and plan B, and that worked. We didn't have to go to plan C.
That's always good. Yeah, comms is obviously something, we do take for granted a little bit, isn't it? And I suppose, like you're saying, having those pre-built plans makes so much difference, because you never know when something you take for granted, like your sat comms or whichever, sort of don't work and things. No, it sounds like an amazing experience. So I guess moving on from that, what are your plans next? What's the next big thing?
Well, just I continue to do what I'm doing. I love splitting the NHS with getting out and about, seeing more of the UK, more of the world. And I'm off to Finland in 2 weeks' time, back for a week, then off to Slovenia, and potentially I'm going to potentially go to Canada in August, and open kayak down the Yukon.
That'll be amazing. I'm not jealous at all. that sounds great. I suppose, what advice have you got for people who are maybe listening to this and thinking that they'd like to sort of follow in your footsteps and do similar things?
So I think it's being confident in what you're going to be doing. And to gain that, you need experience. So I think it's advisable to get experience for yourself in different environments, and being comfortable with being outdoors all day and night, and kit, meals, camping, and from then work on things like multi-day events, so that you're combining long days at work with those environments that you'll be working in, and getting experience in different environments. So I think working for Lowland Rescue and Coast Guards have given me opportunities to learn in different environments, which I don't necessarily always get working frontline the ambulance service.
Yeah, I guess it's about picking up all those transferable skills, isn't it? So the journey from ski work to search and rescue, paramedics and Coast Guard, all these things. And they all kind of blend together. Because, like you say, the last thing you want to do is not be able to sort of survive in the environment. Mm-hmm. So you've obviously got to do that as well as be medical. And it can be challenging. I think that's some really, really good advice. Well, it's been really good talking to you, Donna. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. Maybe we'll share some photos on my website of the trip. Because I think it'd be nice to accompany people listening, just because it does look so good, and it is, like all these things, it's always hard to discuss them in an abstract way, but I wish you the best with those various different trips you've got coming up. They sound fantastic, and thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, then check out our website www.thewildernessmedic.com. If you're interested in being a guest on a future episode or writing a blog for us, then do get in touch and don't forget to follow us on social media. Until next time, take care.